that look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
All right, both of you, welcome to the program. Frank Imspach, let me first start with you. We're looking at an influx of weapons. Aside from the almost $1 billion that the U.S. announced, we're looking at certain details that are coming out, like the Pentagon, as it was reported, scrambling to restock weapons sent to Ukraine. Congress giving the Pentagon $3.5 billion for that effort. How do you assess this influx of weapons that a large portion of it is coming from the U.S.?
Well, I think that the one organization that probably is not interested in ending the war in the Ukraine is the Pentagon. The longer this goes on, the more it costs the Russians, both in terms of their economy, public relations, and practically every other measure of diplomacy. So probably the Pentagon is willing to fight to the last Ukrainian. But I think that we need to be serious about this in this way. Clearly, there has been a huge influx of arms. I think last year it was $1 billion. It's almost like a Stinger missile for every Ukrainian. And I think that the consequences of that are to stoke the likelihood of a continuing and wider war. So if we're going to move beyond where we are today, there has to be an agreement to obviously end the military conflict and not continue to engage in military activities there on our part or the Russians' part. I think this is going to be very, very hard to achieve because right now it appears that the United States, for a variety of reasons, politically, economically, is gaining.
What do you mean by a wider war?
Well, I think the longer this goes on, there will be more and more pressures, the likelihood of mistakes. Perhaps somebody says, well, you know, we can't do a low no-fly zone, but we want to guarantee navigation in the Black Sea. Who knows? You know, there's just such a great, great possibility of miscalculation here that I think that to sort of risk that under these circumstances is folly.
Okay. Well, Marcus Papadopoulos, as if it wasn't bad enough, the threat that Russia feels NATO countries, soldiers have by it moving closer to Russia. Here you have the news of Biden might be announcing plans to put more troops in NATO, where we're understanding that he wants to permanently maintain an increased number of troops in NATO countries near Ukraine. I believe the number at this point ranges anywhere from 100 to 150,000 U.S. soldiers. Isn't that a provocation of some kind, going flatly against what Russia is saying, that this types of moves is what is a threat to Russia?
Well, I have to say that whilst the situation in Eastern Europe is extremely disconcerting, at the same time, the American response to the Russian military campaign in Ukraine has been far more responsible than the hysterical response of the British ruling elite. And I believe the reason for that is quite simple. The Americans are one of the nuclear superpowers in the world. And as a result of that, the Americans have profound obligations to mankind. And therefore, whilst the Americans will continue to arm the Ukrainian armed forces and to arm the Ukrainian nationalist paramilitary groups such as the neo-Nazi Azov Battalion, at the same time, Washington is very much committed to maintaining its communication channels with the Kremlin. And the Kremlin, whilst it will persist with its military campaign in Ukraine, which after nearly 4 weeks has been exceedingly successful, to the point where something like 30% of Ukrainian territory is now controlled by the Russian army. At the same time, Moscow wants to keep open its channels of communication with Washington, because Russia and America are the nuclear superpowers in the world. Therefore, they have a responsibility not just to one another, but to the world in general. And I think we also need to be very clear about something. All that we see happening as regards the West, in terms of the sanctions it has placed on Russia, in terms of how Russian aircraft are banned from entering Western airspace, and the flow of Western weapons to the Ukrainian armed forces and to Ukrainian paramilitaries, is not about Ukraine per se. It is not about democracy in Ukraine and freedom in Ukraine and human rights in Ukraine. No. The response from the West is all about Russia. Namely, it is about asphyxiating the Russian economy so that that will lead to the death of the Russian state, so that America will be again, as it was in the 1990s and in the 2000s, the only global superpower. The Americans are aware that their objectives in Venezuela and Syria were ultimately defeated by Russia. Russia was able to defeat American objectives in those countries because it is a superpower.
Frank Imspach, do you agree?
I think the issue is hegemony here, and that the United States does not intend to become number two. And I've had this feeling for many years, and it's part of the American psyche after World War II. We won, we're in charge. And I think that this is a very dangerous period because of that, because obviously, looking at the situation, particularly if you look at the combination of both Russia and China, and the kind of money that's being put into scientific and technological research, in China in particular, there is a limited lifespan here in terms of America, the United States being the number one all the time on any major subject. And I think that when a power like ours is in that kind of transition, it is extremely dangerous because people in charge don't want to see that happen.
One of the things that was interesting, Marcus Papadopoulos, is the fact that we're looking at how the U.S. is not only Russia, but also it's being covered as such by certain media, that it is discouraging the Ukrainian President Zelensky from actually making concessions to Russia that could end the fighting, saying that the U.S. perhaps is preventing those talks from being fruitful. The State Department signaling that the U.S. Maybe saying, in a sense, not maybe, saying that the war is bigger than Russia and Ukraine and is about universal principles. Do you think that the U.S. Has that intention, and what are its gains behind it?
Ever since the American engineered coup in Kiev in February of 2014, Ukraine has been a vassal state of the West. Therefore, it follows whoever has been prime minister and president in the Ukrainian government has been selected by the Americans. There is no doubt about that whatsoever. And turning to Zelensky, he is merely a puppet. And whilst I strongly suspect he is starting to realize the malevolent nature of his masters in Washington, London, and Brussels, nonetheless, he has very little leeway in all of this. Why? Because he accepted the post of president with conditions. And once you enter a pact with the devil, so to speak, it is almost impossible to get out. And that is why the Americans are really in charge in Kiev. What Zelensky says to the rest of the world has been prepared by scriptwriters in the Pentagon, in the State Department, and of course in the White House. And the Americans, even before the Russian military campaign in Ukraine were looking for an opportunity to goad the Kremlin into taking some sort of military action in Ukraine, knowing that that would give America the opportunity it had been seeking for some years now to impose the most potent sanctions on Russia that the West has ever imposed on another country in its history. So the Americans knew that the Russians would at some point take military action in Ukraine. Now that the Russians have taken military action there, of course, the Americans are looking to draw out the conflict by increasing the flow of arms to the Ukrainian armed forces and Ukrainian nationalist paramilitary groups in the hope that this that Ukraine will become a bleeding wound for the Russian economy, which could bring about a collapse of the Russian government. The reality, of course, is that the Russian people are looking at the fighting in Ukraine as 1941 all over again, when Nazi Germany invaded the Soviet Union. They are resolutely behind President Putin. If there are going to be countries which will suffer or potentially suffer tremendously from the West's economic crusade against Russia, it will be Western countries. Ordinary people in Europe, for example, will struggle to pay the huge increase in electricity and gas and foodstuffs.
Okay, Frank Emsbach, let's take a look at a couple of stats here before I ask the question from you. We're looking at what the Russian foreign minister has said about the deployment of international peacekeepers in Ukraine, which was a move proposed by Poland. He said that could lead to direct confrontation between Russia and NATO. Then you have NATO, who are going to, the news coming out before their meeting, to deploy four new battle groups that are going to that's going to happen in Bulgaria, Hungary, Romania, Slovakia, based on the NATO Secretary General making that announcement. You have already the increase of U.S. Soldiers that's been announced, and it is happening. And I'm giving you all those stats to ask you this question, where Russia has said that if it feels that if there is an existential threat to Russia, that it will consider using nuclear weapons. It seems like there is an existential threat. If you agree, do you think that Russia then will use nuclear weapons?
Well, I certainly hope not, because then it's game over. That was my point earlier about that there are so many things that can go wrong here, that it's an extremely dangerous thing, not only for the Ukrainians or the Russians or anybody else in Western Europe, but the planet. And I hope that this doesn't happen. The best thing to do is not to continue increasing the troops and increasing the armaments. I think we have to understand that. The United States, in their treaty, we have a treaty with Ukraine, a direct treaty, bypassing NATO and bypassing other things. And Secretary of State Blinken said about 2 weeks ago, I think it was, we will never, he used the word never, agree to a situation where Ukraine is demilitarized and a neutral state, something to that effect. And that we will never agree that Ukraine does not have a right to join whoever it wants. Those are very strong diplomatic terms. And so whatever the stuff behind the scenes is, the stuff right out in public is pretty clear as regards our war aims, the United States war aims there, all of which is extremely dangerous. And I think any person of goodwill at this point in the world has got to say, ceasefire, stop the arms race, and begin to withdraw. Because if we don't do that, then something will happen. Look, you've got, aside from anybody deliberately using nuclear weapons, you got 6 or 8 nuclear reactors there, or 10 or whatever. And, you know, all of those are dangerous. Something can go wrong. The electricity goes out. There's no water and things like that. So this is an extremely volatile situation. And I think that we have a responsibility to say to the world leaders and everybody, enough. You have to have a ceasefire. NATO cannot keep putting troops on somebody's border and hope that, you know, that everything's going to work out. And the Russians have to get at least some sense that Ukraine is not going to be used as a springboard against them.
Okay.
Without that, we're not going to get very far here.
Well, unfortunately, the news just keeps getting worse with this special military operation, as Russia calls it. Marcus Papadopoulos, since the sources that I wanted to use, I couldn't confirm through the facts as they presented, I'd like to ask you the information that you may have. And the subject is the flood of what's called foreign fighters going into Ukraine. You have this legion of soldiers, I think, that President Zelensky actually formed, inviting, I guess, foreign fighters or soldiers from abroad, if you can call them that. But Russia has labeled that as foreign fighters, as mercenaries. So it's actually it puts a question mark on it. What is the story behind that, both from the Ukrainian side and from the Russian side, if it's true?
We must be mindful that the propaganda emanating from the Ukrainian government, especially Zelensky, is extremely crude, is extremely childish. And I believe that applies to the claims by the Ukrainian government. And Zelensky quotes that thousands upon thousands of foreign volunteers have arrived in Ukraine. I find that extremely difficult to believe. Indeed, I find most of what emanates from Kyiv regarding the fighting in Ukraine to be totally unbelievable. The very fact that American mainstream media and British mainstream media pay credence to everything that comes out of the mouth of Zelensky just simply demonstrates that Western mainstream media is neither free nor independent nor impartial. But it is true there are some foreign citizens fighting in Ukraine. And we need to understand that, for example, in regard to Britain, that is a criminal offence. British citizens are prohibited by UK law from fighting in another conflict. And I would say this, and also we need to understand that foreign fighters do not have any rights under the Geneva Convention. And in terms of the British volunteers who went to Ukraine, some of whom have actually died in Ukraine, I would say this. The British Foreign Secretary, Liz Truss, who is, of course, not a trained diplomat, she's trying to make a name for herself, is partly responsible because she encouraged British nationals to travel to Ukraine to fight, knowing it is illegal under UK law, and she never told the British population that foreign fighters in Ukraine, or indeed in any conflict anywhere around the world, have no rights under the Geneva Convention. So I believe that Liz Truss has a lot of explaining to do, but at the same time, the numbers which Zelensky is claiming about foreign fighters in Ukraine are quite simply inflated massively.
Frank Emsbeck, so if you maybe test your memory here and tell us how the different wars that the U.S. has been involved in, whether it's in Iraq, whether it's in Syria itself, or in Afghanistan, just to name a few, usually there's special operatives that are on the ground in those war scenarios that are not called U.S. soldiers, perhaps, but they carry special operations, I guess. So do you think that there are special, I guess, people who are trained under the U.S., perhaps special operations that are on the ground in Ukraine that perhaps are training Ukrainian soldiers there? Which brings about the question whether the U.S. at this point is involved in this war. Whether it's, like it or not, it says that, you know, we're not part of this war right now. We're not involved in it in that way.
Well, I have no idea what's going on in terms of special operations or anything like that. The United States withdrew their training contingent about the day the war began or a couple of days before to Poland. I think that there are people, because I've gotten on the plane, they've made announcements, volunteers, American citizens who are fighting in the Ukraine, probably. And that's also a violation of different parts of American law. I think the scenario then becomes rescue Americans if something goes wrong, and that further complicates the proceedings. But, you know, it's hard to know. And I know in the 3 minutes that we have left, we're not going to solve the Ukrainian problem. But I go back to this. The more these things happen, the less likely it is that we're going to be able to solve this and to encourage people to go fight in the Ukraine, as is happening in the press here and some parts of it, is going to be the kind of trigger that causes intervention. It's happened before here. And I think that it's extremely dangerous. And I go back to this. We, people who are commenting like this, need to be able to stress that in order to move here, it's not a question of a secret or of anything else. It's quite out there. We have to insist that the American government stop the escalation, the Russian government agree with the United States for a ceasefire, and proceed from there. Because without that, something is going to happen here. I just don't think it's possible to conceive anything else.
Okay, we're going to have to, unfortunately, end it there. Thank you for that, Frank M. Speck, Professor Emeritus at the University of Wisconsin. Marcos Papadopoulos, thank you, historian, political analyst, and author. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. For Mikhail Vitale, it's goodbye until next time.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
And God said, let there be light, and there was light.
The Creator made Adam in his image, then placed the world in his care. May you walk alongside the Creator in righteousness.
God of Abraham, take my child into thy hands, that he may live to thy service.
God has spoken to us before, through Abraham, Noah, Moses, and through Jesus Christ. Why should we be so surprised that God speaks to us now through Muhammad?
Viewpoint.
A critique of movies with religious themes on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to another edition of the program Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio, with me, Mohammad Javad, and my dear guests and guest speakers, Brother Hussein and Sayyid Abdullah. Brother Hussein, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the program.
Wa alaikum assalam. Glad to be here.
Welcome. And Sayyid Abdullah, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the studio again.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me as always.
You're welcome. Let's take a listen to a short part of this movie, and then we'll be back and I'll ask you the question.
The Illuminati, they disappeared hundreds of years ago.
Did they? Look at that again. It's an ambigram. It's the same image, forward and backward. Now that's common for a symbol like a yin and yang or a
swastika, but that's a word.
That Illuminati ambigrammatic symbol has been considered a myth for 400 years. Supposedly in the 16th century, some artist created it as a tribute to Galileo's love of symmetry. It was only going to be revealed when the Illuminati had amassed enough power to resurface and carry out their final goal. I wrote a book about it. Which is why you're here.
The Art of the Illuminati by Robert Langdon.
Part one. Haven't been able to finish part two because I'm not allowed access to your archives.
Back to the program, Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio. We are still talking about The Angels and Demons, produced in 2009, directed by Ron Howard. Well, you know that we, in fact, started the critique of the movie Angels and Demons from the last episode onward, and this is the second episode that we're going to, in fact, be touching on this movie and the critique of the movie on the question. Let me start it with you, Sayyid Abdullah. You know, there is a lot of reference in this movie to Illuminati, a secret society.
Mm-hmm.
Do you believe in this stuff, or you still think it's a kind of conspiracy theory or something?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, the Illuminati is, as an organization, it's a real organization. It's not a fake organization, which a lot of people don't understand or don't realize. The Illuminati organization was established, I can't remember the date, but it was established by scientists and stuff like that. And their aim was, obviously, they had this this trouble with the church as well.
Mm-hmm.
But
and is it different from the Freemasonry and the stuff like that?
Yeah, no, Freemasons are a different issue altogether.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so it was a real organization to a certain extent, but then it faded away as, you know, science started to become more popular and, you know, start leading the way,
mm-hmm.
and the church kind of backed off. So they kind of vanished.
Mm-hmm.
So now you see that Illuminati thing coming up in Hollywood movies and in the music industry and in a lot of things, and the eye and, you know. I think people naturally, we like anything that has a sense of adventure to it.
Mm-hmm.
If you call it like a conspiracy theory or what have you, we
yes.
kind of get into it. I think there was a movie made by Nicolas Cage, something about the Illuminati's, like, and they mixed the Illuminati's and the Freemasons together, and
uh-huh.
and, you know, it's called Treasure Hunt.
Yeah.
So anything with that, with this elements of mystery,
mm-hmm.
conspiracy, secret organization, it kind of intrigues.
Only to
the
make
mind
it attractive to a lot of people, right?
Mm-hmm.
Only to make it attractive to a lot of
exactly.
people.
Exactly. So this is our nature. We'd like to solve mysteries. So mm-hmm. when you give me a mystery and you tell me there's a secret
yes.
organization that has this and that, we kind of go by it.
Mm-hmm.
But the Illuminati themselves was just an organization that was just trying to spread knowledge. Nothing more, nothing less. So they
mm-hmm.
didn't have no agendas. They had no secret society as now has been published in the media or publicized. And I think that was just they hijacked the actual Illuminati just to, you know, even the name itself, it means enlightenment. It
mm-hmm.
doesn't mean anything. But because it's Latin, it sounds mysterious as when Illuminati's, you know? So it's got hijacked, and now you can see. So the movie itself, Angels and Demons, they touched upon that,
mm-hmm.
but they made it into a feud between the church and the actual organization, which that did not happen. That did not take place.
I see.
So these guys were by themselves. They were trying to do their own thing. They did not care much about the church, nor did the church care much about them.
Mm-hmm.
But in the movie, they had to, you know, make it like a kind of feud between them.
Mm-hmm, I see. Thank you very much. Let's take a short break and listen to a part of the movie, and then we'll be back and ask the relevant question related to that movie.
What do you want from me?
These criminals who sent this ambigram meant it as a taunt, a provocation. But Captain Olivetti think if you can use it to learn their identity, perhaps we can stop this abomination.
Why me?
Your expertise, your erudition, your recent involvement with certain church, shall we say, mysteries?
I wasn't under the impression that episode had endeared me to the Vatican.
Oh, it didn't. But it did make you... It was formidable.
Formidable?
A Vatican jet is standing by 20 minutes from here. Will you come with me?
Back to the program, Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio. We are still talking about The Angels and Demons, produced in 2009, directed by Ron Howard. Brother Hossein, you know, we see that, in fact, in this movie or in the other related movie or its sequel, there's a kind of turning on the part of the church to science and scientists. Now, the priests are, in fact, trying to ask the scientists for a favor. Well, this is somehow odd, you know, especially despite its history, the history of church, you know, and Christianity, where we can see a lot of like split between the two, between science and religion in that sense, of course, in the Christian sense of the word, you know. So against all that, we see there's an emphasis on the Vatican and Pope and the priests and cardinals, you know, turning to Tom Hanks as a professor from Harvard University to solve an issue for them. Isn't it like this?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yeah, it is kind of ironic. Mm-hmm. But in terms of scientists, I feel like, you know, forensic evidence or whatever they use to investigate the crime, you know, I guess that's the more scientific aspect of it. But other than that, you know, it was pretty standard, you know, looking around detective stuff. Like, I didn't notice any more scientific, you know, relations between them.
But, no, because he was a symbologist, right?
Yeah.
So he studied symbology at university, academically speaking.
Academically speaking. That's
not
fine.
Of self-study or something which is usually learned or educated, for example, somewhere else at another non-academic center.
Yeah, it is you know, pretty interesting that they chose to you know, seek help from a professional who studied, you know, academically. I mean, at the end of the day, they knew they had to because he got them results.
Is there any kind of hidden message behind this movie trying to balance or, let's say, bridge the gap between science and religion?
I think in some sense, yeah. They do show, you know, how you know, more modern they're getting, or, you know, more open-minded they're trying to be.
Mm-hmm.
But of course there still is that, you know, that gap, because you look at the facts, you look at the evidence,
right.
And the, you know, there are two different sides of the same coin, I think.
I see. Thank you very much, Brother Hossein. We are still talking about the movie Angels and Demons in this program, Viewpoint, the movie critic program on IRIB English Radio. Stay with us when we come back. I'm going to ask Sayyid Abdullah another question, which is quite relevant to the topic and the theme that we have under question here.
The Illuminati did not become violent until the 17th century. Their name means the Enlightened Ones. They were physicists and mathematicians, astronomers. They were concerned with the church's inaccurate teaching, and they were dedicated to scientific truth. But the Vatican didn't like that. So the church began to, how did you say it? Oh, hunt them down and kill them. Drove them underground into a secret society.
Back to the program, Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio. With me, Mohammad Javad, hosting this program, and we are criticizing the movie Angels and Demons, produced in 2009, directed by Ron Howard and starred by Tom Hanks in it, and even MacGregor. Well, Sayyid Abdullah, you know, why do some groups, let's say, more specifically religious groups, well, become extremist and use violence in order to get things done or fight for a cause or something like that, you know? Why does it only happen to religious groups mostly? Is it because of their ideology, or we don't see scientists? Do we have any history with the, like, science and scientists that become or go mad, apart from the atomic bombs, of course, mm-hmm. right? I know what you may refer to that, you know. But it happens pretty often to religious organizations, secret societies. They go underground, usually, right?
Yeah.
Don't you agree with me?
Well, I mean, historically speaking, the Illuminati themselves, as a group, the actual group, they were responsible for the French Revolution, mind you.
Yes.
Which a lot of people don't know. So they kind of, because they wanted to make sure that they get the point across, and the religious...
Did they have any religious background?
No. So that's the problem. So they wanted to fight superstition,
right,
and religious beliefs, which they thought is controlling people. So in a way to get rid of this control of mind control of religion or superstition. Yes. Mm-hmm. They started forming their Illuminati thing, and they were starting trying to bring people to logic and science.
Yes.
And then, for example, if you look at France before the French Revolution, it was like mainly religious dominance. And when the people were like oppressed to such an extreme, and they were like poverty was like at its peak, they could not tolerate it any longer. So when they came along, they found the supporters, and then you know it led to the French Revolution. And now, when you say why is it religious people, maybe not back in the day, maybe now, because back in the day, as the further you go back,
yes,
the more dominance was religious. Religion and the whoever follows them. Mm-hmm. So there wasn't much opposition there. Why do certain religious people or groups become violent? And that's, I think it's a simple answer. When they don't have time or space to practice their own beliefs, when they are oppressed, then they go back to the doctrines which emphasize on them holding to their beliefs strongly and fighting for it. So they end up taking to a violent stand. So, for example, if you look at Christianity or Islam itself,
right,
you will see all these groups that turned to be violent. It's because they were oppressed in a way or another. So they weren't free to express their doctrines or their theology or their teachings to their followers freely. And they had to, the more they were pushed underground, the more they became violent,
mm-hmm,
because they wanted to fight for their rights. So, for mm-hmm example, and so, mind you, when we say this, we don't say it's a bad thing as well. I mean, if you are oppressed, you're meant to fight for your freedom.
Exactly.
At least your freedom of speech. So yes, it's not always bad. It's only bad when you use your religion and your faith as a mean to kill people.
And trample on other people's rights.
Exactly. So, for example, if you take a look at the Crusaders.
Yes.
When they came, under the name of Christianity, they were mm-hmm massacring everybody.
Yes.
And even the Muslims, mind you, even what we call the Futuhat al-Islamiyya, the Islamic openings,
yes,
where they reached Spain by the sword,
mm-hmm,
it wasn't justified Islamically. Yes. I mean, even Imam Ali, exactly, he stood against them. But under the name of Islam, they were doing
what
we call...
We also have the story of Khawarij, mind you.
Exactly. So, under the name of divide and conquer,
mm-hmm,
they use the Islamic, you know, flag, and yeah, they managed to get all the way to Spain, which they had no right. And yes, they were also massacring people under mm-hmm the name of Islam.
Yes.
So if that happens, this is something rejected.
Mm-hmm.
But me and you, if I have a faith, and you have a faith, and I want to practice my faith freely, if you try to oppress me, what you're going to find is resistance.
Exactly.
There you go.
Defense. Okay, thank you very much, Sayyid Abdullah and Brother Hussein, for your nice contribution to the program Viewpoint, the movie critique program on RIB English Radio. From me and the rest of the crew, we say wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
This is the first sign.
What sort of sign?
Earth, air, fire, water. And the fifth sign.
May God forgive you for what you've done.
Father, if God has issues, they won't be with what we've done. They'll be with what we're about to do.
Our church is at war.
Hey!
This is the first marker. The path is alive. You're talking about the moment of creation.
Open the doors and tell the world the truth.
It has to be here!
This is it.
This is the truth. Angels and demons.
Happy Iranian New Year. Happy Nowruz. In lockstep with spring, the season of renewal and freshness, and the greening of nature, we here at RIB English Radio wish you happiness and prosperity.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
A delegation from the International Academic Campaign Against Occupation and Apartheid headed to the offices of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, OHCHR, as well as the UN Special Coordinator's Office, UNSCO, in Gaza. They handed the memorandum on Israeli apartheid signed by around 70 international organizations, human rights networks, academics, and researchers from 45 countries. The campaign is calling on the United Nations and Western countries to impose sanctions on the Israeli regime for its occupation of the Palestinian territories and its apartheid regime. The Israeli regime is an occupying power and has kept the Gaza Strip under a crippling blockade since 2007 and also waged four wars on the tiny enclave.
We are here to condemn Israeli apartheid, and we call on the international community to support the Palestinian people. We also demand and end the Israeli crimes. Israeli leaders must face justice for their crimes against the Palestinian people.
Tel Aviv also practices apartheid policies against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. Among Israel's apartheid policies is the demolition of Palestinian homes in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. Israel also keeps thousands of Palestinian prisoners in its jails under inhumane detention conditions. Israeli forces also use excessive force to kill and maim peaceful Palestinian protesters in the blockaded Gaza Strip as well as in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds.
Today we are here to prove that the crimes of the occupations against the Palestinians and the prisoners must be documented and to support the Palestinians to obtain their rights.
Last month, at least 277 human rights groups and civil society organizations around the world denounced Israeli officials for imposing apartheid on Palestinians.
Observers say that Israel's apartheid against Palestinians is a cruel system of domination that constitutes a crime against humanity. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian arrived in Damascus heading a high-ranking delegation. He met with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and discussed the implementation of bilateral cooperation agreements. Talks covered cooperation in fighting terrorism, in which Abdullahian renewed Iran's support to Syria for the full liberation of all its territories. The top diplomat briefed President Assad on the Vienna talks on the revival of the JCPOA. Assad hailed Iran for adhering to principles and rights in the track adopted during the negotiations. He asserted that reaching a deal has become more important in service of Iran and the region's interest as well as international equilibrium.
We had good meetings with President Assad and Foreign Minister Faisal Maqdood. We welcome the new approach by some Arab states in restoring relations with Syria. We reaffirmed Iran's readiness to develop relations with Syria and discuss increasing the level of tourist exchange. We hope that in the near future, the presidents of both countries would meet.
A separate meeting was also held between the foreign ministers of Syria and Iran. Focus was laid on the notable increase of trade exchange and means of overcoming the impact of economic sanctions on the two countries.
We discussed means of confronting unilateral illegal sanctions on both states as well as developments currently happening in the meetings of the Syrian Constitutional Committee in Geneva. Syria and Iran's stances are identical in this regard. We are in favor of a successful result. However, the other side is not working for national interests.
Syria was the first destination of the regional tour of the Iranian delegation, which also includes Lebanon.
Abdullahian's visit is one of many exchanged between both countries' officials. It signals the extensive and continuous cooperation between the two allies at all times, which resulted in a defeat of terror in Syria and currently aims to boost economic partnerships. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Poland's support for fellow Europeans fleeing Ukraine is receiving much praise.
However, this has been a huge turnaround, for in past years, the Eastern European country has been heavily criticised for a proud anti-immigration stance, particularly hostile towards Muslim refugees.
Angela Merkel started this madness, and now this is a problem about Muslims mainly coming to Europe.
Amid the anti-Islam rhetoric, Press TV decided to investigate how local Muslims live under these types of challenges.
The Muslim community that lives here in Poland is small but very passionate. It's estimated somewhere between 25 to 40,000 Muslims currently live in the country, making up about 0.1% of the current population, as it's estimated. The majority of them are native Tatars, but also there has been an immigration of Muslims to Poland from various countries. We've come here to one of the main mosques in the capital, Warsaw, to meet the community firsthand.
The imam explained that his main focus has always been to re-educate Poles about Islam and demonstrate Islamic teachings through good deeds.
We teach Quran, we teach Arabic language, and we teach something about Islam. Yes. During Ramadan, because Ramadan is near now, we're making soon 1992, we're making food and iftar for everybody. Every day. From time to time, also, we're making open day. This is for non-Muslims to come to our mosque, to hear something and listen about Islam. We made in March open day, and during this activity, 5 women accept Islam.
Despite these successes, Islamophobia still rears its ugly head from time to time. But the mosque uses Islam to combat this also.
One time only, the Polish youth came in front of this masjid and said some bad words about Islam. But I went to them and invited them to here to take a cup of tea, and they became friendly.
In past years, it was Islamic immigration that was considered the major threat in Eastern Europe. Now it's Russia. But conflict in Europe has historically catapulted dangerous ideologies into the forefront. Muslims in Europe look on with caution. Robert Carter, Warsaw.
Yemen's Eye of Humanity Center for Rights and Development has held a press conference in the capital Sana'a to release its latest statistics of 7 years of Saudi Arabia's war and siege on its neighboring Arab country. The report says more than 46,000 civilians have been killed or injured, including women and the children.
During 7 years, the Saudi-led coalition committed horrific crimes amounting to genocide. There were 46,262 civilians who got killed and wounded as a result of the direct targeting of the Saudi-led coalition's aircraft, including more than 8,000 children and 5,000 women. There is also systematic destruction and targeting of service and economic infrastructure. And the Saudi coalition's air force continues to target roads, bridges, and civilian objects to this day.
The report says more than 500,000 homes were destroyed due to Saudi Arabia's air attacks and thousands of families were displaced. Also, the figures show further destruction of the country's infrastructure.
For 7 years, Saudi Arabia has committed war crimes against Yemeni civilians, but unfortunately, the international community did not fulfill its duty to stop these crimes. Therefore, we see today the Yemeni army intensifying its operations against Saudi territories, and this is a legitimate right, as it is self-defense.
Since the beginning of the war, Saudi Arabia has clearly violated international law multiple times by targeting residential areas across Yemen using cluster munitions. However, this has not pushed the international community to take any measures against Riyadh's war crimes.
After 7 years of killing and destruction in Yemen, observers say Saudi Arabia has not achieved any of its announced goals. On the contrary, Riyadh is facing more retaliatory attacks by the Yemeni forces deep inside its territory. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
This is the second OIC conference Pakistan hosted in 3 months. In December, foreign ministers from the OIC held an extraordinary session to discuss the humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan. But the latest session was a regular one with an ambitious agenda on the table. Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan opened the conference while regretting how the OIC failed both the people of Palestine and Kashmir.
We have failed both the Palestinians and the people of Kashmir. I'm sad to say that we have been able to make no impact at all. They don't take us seriously. We are a divided house, and those powers know it.
For the first time, the Chinese foreign minister attended the OIC conference as a special guest. In his speech, Wang, he said Beijing wants to work closely with the Islamic countries.
China stands ready to work with the Islamic countries to actively advocate true multilateralism, safeguard the purposes and principles of the UN Charter, uphold the UN-centered international system.
The issue of Ukraine also came up for discussions. The OIC Secretary General stressed the need for political solution to the crisis, as he feared the conflict would endanger international peace and stability. The OIC conference coincided with Pakistan Day celebrations. The delegates also attended the National Day parade.
The two-day conference concluded with OIC members adopting over 100 resolutions. But observers believe that Islamic countries representing 1.5 billion people need to make a difference through actions, as mere statements are not enough. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Cartoons often have the power, by drawing attention quickly and getting straight to the point, to uncover deceit and deliver uncomfortable, shocking messages. In a span of over 25 years since the early 60s, late Palestinian cartoonist Najih al-Ali produced over 40,000 drawings and several books of cartoons, raising awareness on the Palestinian plight at the hands of Israeli settlers and harshly criticizing Arab regimes and the U.S. imperialistic policies. Today, a book containing tens of cartoons by al-Ali has been published for the first time in Italy.
We have published this book because presently the Palestinian struggle has been put on hold. Nobody talks about it anymore, but the Israeli occupation continues and the elimination of an entire population is ongoing. Ali and his character, Handala, serve as an example of how a cartoon can be more useful than an intifada to stop the occupation and lift the veil of lies covering Palestine.
Najih al-Ali's most famous character is Handala, a 10-year-old barefoot child dressed in ragged clothes. The boy, always drawn from behind while watching all the bad that is happening on Earth, has over time become a symbol of the Palestinian resistance, giving voice to the poor and oppressed. This year marks the 35th anniversary of the assassination of Handala's creator Najih al-Ali, as he was murdered outside a newspaper office in the UK in 1987. 5 years ago, London's police department reopened its investigation into the unsolved murder of the Palestinian political cartoonist.
Najih al-Ali's work was for a long time reflective of the Palestinian cause. His cartoons were very critical of everybody involved in the Palestinian plight. Handala means bitter in Arabic and well represents the struggle of the Palestinians. The fact that the boy was drawn from behind meant that everybody, including the Arabic world, had turned their back to Palestine. Al-Ali's assassination was plotted by dark powers, certainly close to the Mossad.
Najih al-Ali's book was recently launched in Naples. It will also be presented in several other Italian cities, including Rome, Genoa, and Bologna. Max Civili, Rome.
On World Water Day, water pollution has reached an alarming level in the besieged Gaza Strip. The enclave's coastal aquifer is almost completely polluted with various contaminants. The groundwater in Gaza has high levels of nitrates and other dangerous pollutants, with contamination levels 3 times higher than international standards for safe drinking water. The Israeli regime has imposed tight restrictions on the entry of badly needed equipment to maintain water and sewer systems and targeted them during wars.
Today, about 98% of our municipal water wells, drinking water wells, their water quality does not fit with the WHO standards related to the drinking water standards.
In recent years, Gaza municipalities were forced to pump untreated road sewage directly into the sea due to lack of electricity for treatment plants. Road sewage seepage into the ground has worsened the water crisis. Palestinian officials say Israel has for years deprived residents of Gaza of healthy water supply and stolen their underground resources.
Israel tried to steal our groundwater by having their pumping wells along the eastern border of Gaza Strip and preventing the flow of groundwater by gravity, by lowering the water table and reverse the direction of the groundwater at that location.
The Israeli blockade and wars have taken their toll on Gaza's water infrastructure. Experts say the tiny seaside sliver is currently in a chronic state of water emergency.
Gaza is suffering due to the water catastrophe with full meaning. Shortage of water, and at the same time we have polluted water. We are calling on the international community in order to end this blockade, which is one of the main reasons for such catastrophe that we are living in.
According to human rights organizations, depriving people of water supplies is a clear breach of international law.
On World Water Day, experts say that the complete lifting of the Israeli blockade is the first step towards easing the water crisis in the coastal enclave. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Amid the ongoing fuel crisis in Yemen, the Ministry of Human Rights has held a press conference in front of the United Nations office in Yemen's capital Sana'a to shed further light on the catastrophic consequences of Saudi Arabia's illegal seizure of Yemen's oil ships.
The intensification of the siege and the attempt to harm the public service sectors, especially the health sector, which needs electricity permanently, will cause more civilians, including women and children, to be killed. We believe that the United Nations is seeking to prolong the war to benefit from the donor countries' funds, and also because it grants fuel ships transit permits and then provides political cover-up for the piracy acts carried out by the Saudi-led coalition.
Ministry of Human Rights says the fuel crisis has impacted all aspects of life in the war-torn country, including healthcare services, transportation, and public services.
We held this press conference in the presence of many service sector officials to send a message to the world that those who pay lip service to human rights are themselves besieging the Yemeni people. The humanitarian situation today continues to deteriorate, and the Saudi blockade has affected all aspects of life, including the health sector, transportation, and public services. The international community must take serious steps to end the Saudi war in Yemen as they seek to end the Russian-Ukrainian conflict.
Recently, Saudi Arabia has been tightening the blockade it has imposed on Yemen and has prevented the entry of fuel ships to Hodeidah port despite obtaining UN permits. This has led Yemen to the worst fuel crisis since the beginning of the war on March 2015.
People here say the Yemeni army's recent retaliatory attacks against Saudi Arabia's vital facilities are a normal reaction to Riyadh's illegal measures against Yemen's fuel imports. They believe that the Yemeni army will eventually break the Saudi siege, as Riyadh only understands the language of force. Abdullah Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Since late last week, France has seen nationwide anti-government protests almost every day. March 17th's protests were over better pay and working conditions. March 19th saw the yellow vests and protests against state-sponsored Islamophobia and racism. While March 21st saw the record price of gasoline cause taxi drivers, truckers, fishermen, and others to protest nationwide. President Emmanuel Macron has joined the European Union's unprecedented sanction drive against top energy supplier Russia for its military operation in Ukraine, regardless of the economic costs on the average French household. The price of petrol has crossed the psychological barrier of 2 euros per liter, creating inflation in goods across the board. Those on low and fixed incomes are now being told to make sacrifices by politicians who may be living far more comfortable lifestyles.
Moi, je pense qu'ils souffrent vraiment.
I think that people are really suffering. Unfortunately, this doesn't mean much to our leaders. There are elderly people who live off canned sardines, if not canned cat food. French politics is 30 years behind where it should be. And if it doesn't change, there might be a civil war here.
Adding to the hardships being asked of the average French voter,